I think a Latter-day Saint ethic must begin with our core theological and ethical principle that we are all children of God, that yeah. every single human being is a child of heavenly parents, and therefore bears the spark of divinity and has unlimited and inviolable human dignity.
Welcome to Dialogue Unbound, where we, Caroline Klein and Margaret Olson Hemming, the editors of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. So, this is our inaugural episode for this podcast, and we're starting out with something that is honestly a little bit weighty, but also incredibly important. War, peace, and what Mormon theology has to say about both. And Caroline and I felt like, of all of the topics that we wanted to start out with, this was perhaps the most salient as we look at the headlines of what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a weighty topic. You know, we all hear what's going on in the news right now with just terrible atrocities in the headlines. So this is an important issue to address right now. But before you click away and think that this is all going to be just negative and gloomy, please do stick with us. In this episode, we're going to be highlighting an amazing conversation that we had with Patrick Mason. He is the author of many books, including Proclaim Peace, The Restoration's Answer to an Age of Conflict. And he helped us to explore how our theology can actually offer a really hopeful, challenging vision of peacemaking.
Patrick wrote a 2004 article on LDS theology and possibilities of peacemaking. He's developed those ideas over the past couple of decades, and we have made an audio version of that article that is now available on the Dialogue Audio podcast. So we encourage you to click over there. We'll link to it in the show notes, and you can listen to the article. And then Patrick will also reflect on that podcast, on that article, in this interview with him, and talk about the current state of peace building within the tradition. So what it looks like, how the discourse has changed over 20 years, and what regular people can do to build peace in their communities. But before we launch into our conversation with him, we wanted to talk a little bit with each other and reflect on what we took away from this conversation. So, Caroline, tell me, what did you think was the most moving part of the interview?
I was really struck by a moment in the interview when Patrick talked about how the basis of any kind of Mormon ethic of peace has to be that all people on all sides of issues are children of God. They all have humanity, and this humanity must be recognized. And he kind of told a story that illuminated that a little bit. He talked about how maybe when he was younger, he might not have always had the most charitable opinions of, say, people who work in the military, what's it called? The security apparatus for the country, like think the CIA and things like that. But that he actually ended up going to conferences and talking to people that worked for these organizations and realized that, you know, these are not amoral people. These are people that are wrestling deeply with issues of morality, that embrace very seriously, in many cases, their Christian identities and beliefs. And so that he just had like this understanding, my gosh, like I can't just write these people off. Like, they are totally human and we have to be listening to each other. We cannot demonize one another.
I found it really interesting. He kind of leads off talking about the progress that's been made And I don't know, maybe I tend to be a little bit of more of a pessimist than Patrick is, but a lot of what he described of the progress that he's seen did kind of feel like, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that, or it hadn't really consciously registered with me. He talked about, you know, the opening of various peace centers at church schools, church-owned schools. And he also talked quite a bit about President Nelson's talks in general conference about being peacemakers, and how that has rippled out not only on sort of a local level, but he sees it as even changing how some of the other general authorities are talking. Well, we hope you enjoy this interview with Patrick Mason. Let's give it a listen. Patrick, thank you so much for being here. We're really excited to have you here in our inaugural episode of Dialogue Unbound.
Yes, Patrick, thank you so much for coming on. It is such a privilege to have you here and to talk with you about this important subject.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm such fans of both of you and your work, and so I'm excited for the conversation.
So it has been two decades since you published The Possibilities of Mormon Peacebuilding in Dialogue. I would love for you to revisit this article and tell us, what are your thoughts as you think about this article now? Has your original vision or your sense of possibility for peacebuilding changed in any way since then?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm disappointed that we haven't achieved world peace in the past 20 years. I guess my one article in Dialogue wasn't enough to get us over that hump. It is interesting to reflect on. I mean, it was more than 20 years ago that I wrote that article. I wrote it while I was in graduate school at the University of Notre Dame, while I was getting a master's degree in peace studies there. And it bears some of the marks of the writings of a grad student, you know, so I might do a few things a little bit differently in the article itself. But in terms of the argument and what I was trying to say in it, I'm still pretty happy with it, in the sense that I still believe what I wrote back then. If anything, more than ever, I've developed a lot of the ideas that I kind of tested out there. You mentioned my book, Proclaim Peace, that I wrote along with David Pulsifer. That's where we really flesh out that, especially the scriptural theology of peace and nonviolence. And so I've gone a lot further in some of that thinking. And I have to say that in terms of whether Latter-day Saints have moved any further down the road in terms of what I called for in that article, I would say that there are some really positive signs, and actually some really encouraging signs. I am, you know, in those 20 years, BYU Hawaii built a very successful intercultural peacebuilding program. It became one of their, and is one of their most popular majors. That are training literally thousands of students, a lot of them from the South Pacific and the Pacific Rim, in peacebuilding and mediation, and they're going back into their home country. So that is incredible. Now BYU Idaho has started a peacebuilding curriculum that is very popular and that thousands of students are taking. And then a lot of independent and individual Latter-day Saints are taking up peacebuilding in lots of different ways. And just none of that was on the map in 2004. And so in those ways, I'm really encouraged. I also think that President Nelson has changed things, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit more, but he, more than any other Latter-day Saint prophet, has talked about peace and peacebuilding and peacemaking as a central and repeated message in General Conference. And I think that really matters. Now has the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints become a peace church, you know, like the Mennonites or like some other groups? No. So some of those tensions still exist, and I think there's still a lot of room for growth within the community. But absolutely, we're in a different place in 2025 than we were in 2004.
I love hearing so many of these positive developments, and especially love hearing this in the midst of our current political environment, with our growing polarization and religious nationalism that's emerging, you know, even within some LDS circles. And so you have not found those things having a negative effect on the possibilities of peace building within Mormonism.
Well, those things certainly exist, and there's always this tension. And in some ways, you know, it's like the Book of Mormon, which you suggested, right? I mean, there is no greater and more powerful passage about nonviolence and the power of collective nonviolence in all of Scripture than in the Book of Mormon with the anti-Nephi Lehis, right? When David Pulsifer and I share that at conferences with other peacemakers who are not Latter-day Saints, who are not familiar with the Book of Mormon, they're like, what? Like that's like classic Gandhian nonviolence, like 100 years before Gandhi. Like, where did that come from, right? And so, but then you also have this strong militarist streak within the Book of Mormon as well, with Captain Moroni and all the others, of course, starting with Nephi and Laban and all of that. And I think that's true within our broader Latter-day Saint culture, too, that we have multiple strands when it comes to these questions of war and peace and violence and nonviolence and so forth. We have multiple strands and multiple approaches. I think there is this growing peace community within the church, but there is. And then I would say most people within the church live, you know, lives of peace and peacefulness in terms of their everyday lives, but they believe, you know, and when it comes to kind of national and international things, something like maybe kind of a just war theology or something like that. But then there are some who I think are taking their cues oftentimes from other religious groups, frankly, who have been influenced by some of these ideas around Christian nationalism and so forth. And then they sort of put it in Book of Mormon garb or in Latter-day Saint garb. Maybe they'll draw on some statements from Ezra Taft Benson or some other things like that. So we have that as well. So within the community, I think we have a whole range of responses and views. And I think for the most part, we all just live in our separate little bubbles. I actually don't see a lot of places where these different approaches on this have come and really engaged with one another in any kind of significant way. They just kind of almost kind of either don't know about or pretend like the other people don't really exist or don't have relationships with those other people. So I think that's where we're at. There may be some point where we're forced, you know, to have those conversations, and that'll be interesting if and when that happens. But certainly I think Latter-day Saints right now are, you know, exist all along the spectrum in terms of responses to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just am still really happy. Like, institutionally, it sounds like there has been more of a space carved for peace building and for a focus on peace, even as certain segments of the LDS population may go in a different direction. So that is just such a positive development. And thank you for talking about both sides of this equation.
I think when President Nelson says, like, to be a Christian is to be a peacemaker, right? And to say it repeatedly, that wasn't just like a one-off. He said that in multiple conference talks. He emphasized it again in his, you know, the most recent one in April 2025. So what that means, like, we, especially when it comes from the president of the church, that kind of rhetoric matters, because it means that even if you're kind of, you know, peace and peace building oftentimes have, they're coded left or lefty, right? Especially since the 60s, right? And I rarely, if ever, use the word pacifism. Again, that's been coded in a certain kind of way. But when the president of the church, and nobody confuses President Nelson for a raging liberal, right? Unless you disagree with him on masks and things like that. But when he says peacemaking is at the heart of the gospel, it means that you have to grapple with that. You have to make sense of that in some way. Now lots of people have waged war in the name of peace, right? I mean, there's lots of ways that people do that. But it means that Latter-day Saints have to take the concept of peace seriously and say, no, that's not just a lefty peacenik, you know, 1960s hippie thing.
From my own experience, I see this happening in my own ward because of President Nelson's words, where conversations and disagreements about peace building were not something that casually entered into Relief Society meetings or into Sunday school meetings. And now they are. And it, that isn't to say that there's unity on the topic or everyone is saying, you know, yes, we should be pacifists, but there is conversation about it, which I didn't used to see. So there's certainly a huge shift there, I think.
And that's been my experience too. When I wrote this article and when Dialogue published it, and I was so grateful that Dialogue did, right? I mean, again, a grad student, it was really one of the first things I'd published. I'm so grateful for Dialogue for helping to launch that and to create space for it. But like when I wrote that and when I would tell people that I was in a peace studies program or that I wrote on peace building and I was interested in this stuff, like people looked at me like I was from Mars, right? Or they would say, well, what about Captain Moroni, right? Or they would just sort of like pat me on the head and be sort of patronizing, like, oh, isn't that nice that like you care about peace, right? Because there wasn't that space, Margaret, that you're talking about. It just wasn't part of the common discourse. Now, again, that doesn't mean that most Latter-day Saints were warmongers in 2004, right? But it just means that, like, our rhetoric, our cultural narratives, like the stories that we told, it's just like we talk a lot more about covenants nowadays than we did, you know, when I was growing up. Because again, leadership matters in terms of setting the tone for what, you know, there's hundreds of things you could talk about. So what are the things that leadership is going to say that these are the important things for us to talk about in relief society?
Yeah. So I also got a degree in peace studies. And when I was doing this degree, one of my professors insisted that religion is never the true cause of violence. He would say that it's an identity marker that is exploited by those who benefit from conflict in order to solidify group identity and easily mark who is the other or who is the one that you are supposed to hate. And I think that that is very interesting, considering some of the major conflicts we're looking at today, including in Gaza. But I would love to hear, what do you think of this theory and where do you see it at work today in the world or locally? And how can Latter-day Saints best respond to conflict with that theory in mind as a religious people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll try to be short, and I say that because I here at Utah State, I developed an entire course called Religion, Violence, and Peace, where we spent an entire semester basically taking up that very question. And, you know, does religion cause conflict? How does it operate in it? How is it used as a resource for peace building? For me, social identity and personal identity is so complicated. Like, it's really hard to disentangle any one strand and just isolate it completely on its own. I don't care whether you're talking about race or religion or gender, right? Those things are always intertwined. Now, sometimes they're in the front, right? They're in the driver's seat of the bus, and other times they're more in the back seat. But it's really hard to figure out, you know, our identities are all like a clown car. There's like just like all this stuff packed in there. And it's hard to even know where one ends and the other one begins. And I think religion is that way because, you know, so for a lot of our listeners, for a lot of Dialogue readers, religion will be a really salient identity marker, right? But how do you disentangle that from family? How do you disentangle that from culture? How do you disentangle that about the way you think about it in terms of your gendered identity and so forth, right? Yeah, and so it's I appreciate the sentiment of like, oh, no, religion isn't the main cause of conflict, because oftentimes that's an answer to people saying, oh, like religion, just like religion is genocidal and religious people are just fanatics who go around killing each other. Right? It's American primeval and stuff like that. Right. And so it's a nice corrective to that. But to reduce religion and to say that it's always sort of in the backseat and all these other social markers are always more important, that's actually reductionistic on how important religion is for a lot of people, right? I mean, think about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Was that because of Mormonism? Well, yes, no, maybe. Yes, I mean, yes and no, and right, all of those kinds of things all at once. Or the 1838, you know, Missouri War, or the anti-Mormon persecutions, was it primarily about religion? Yes, no, maybe, right? Those are debates we can have, but it's always complicated. So what I always think about is that I want to think about it, and actually this came about from my training in peace studies, as well as in history, is actually to embrace complexity, right? To try not to reduce things to say, oh no, it's really about race and anything else like doesn't really matter. No, but you know, it can be about multiple things at the same time. And so religion is clearly a participant and sometimes an accelerant in conflict, but it also is a participant and can be an accelerant for peace building, right? Some of the greatest peace building movements, they weren't purely religious, but they got rocket fuel out of religion. Think about the civil rights movement, right? In the 1950s and 60s, it's Reverend Martin Luther King, right? Where did they meet? They met in churches. They were singing hymns, right? Religion became the framework and the power through which the medium, the vocabulary, the organizing principle through which they went out and worked for voting rights and all the, you know, things that seemed quite secular. So for me, it's just really hard to disentangle those things. But I do always want to admit that religion is and can be and has been an accomplice and part of conflict, including violent conflict. But it also, that means it can be part of the solution as well.
Yeah, I love that. And just to add on to that, to think about conflict that can seem to be just about a religion, that religion can be exploited by people who
yes.
benefit from the conflict.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And we can see lots of places where religion is used cynically, right? Oftentimes we see this where leaders themselves are not personally religious, but they use the language and vocabulary of religion to motivate lots of people. We saw this, for instance, in the war in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, like Slobodan Milosevic, right? He didn't have a religious bone in his body, but he mobilized and frankly manipulated Serbian Orthodoxy to commit some of those horrible war crimes. So and that's been replicated in lots of places all around the world.
Yeah, yeah. So if we were to get into specifics and not just sort of theory about conflict, in Gaza, we're witnessing immense human suffering, I think beyond a scale than that we can really understand in our own social context. And that is alongside entrenched narratives of security and resistance. So I'm wondering, what does a Latter-day Saint ethic of peace suggest for engaging with or refusing to engage with these competing narratives when you have tenets of our religion that sympathize with both sides of a conflict? Yeah. How do you tackle that?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, the situation in Gaza is so enormously complex and tragic, and it just continues to unfold almost every day. It seems there's some new tragedy that's unthinkable. And of course, all of this begins with the unthinkable tragedy of October 7th, 2023 as well. And then, you know, that this is the classic case of like, how far do you want to rewind this tape, right? Unthinkable tragedy upon unthinkable tragedy for years and decades, stretching back a very long ways. And you're exactly right. That's what feeds these cultural narratives and the stories that we tell about it. I think for Latter-day Saints, And in some ways, this answer will sound maybe not trivial, but simplistic. But I really don't think it is. That I think a Latter-day Saint ethic must begin with our core theological and ethical principle that we are all children of God. That yeah. every single human being is a child of heavenly parents. And therefore bears the spark of divinity and has unlimited and inviolable human dignity. We have to start there. So now, and we all say, yeah, well, of course, everybody's a child of God. But what that means is that the Hamas militant who killed and raped Israelis on October 7th is a child of God, just like the victims of that Hamas militant were children of God. That the IDF soldier or the people who are orchestrating the bombing campaigns and, you know, the soldiers who are shooting civilians, they are children of God. And the civilians and the children who are completely innocent of anything, that they are children of God. So on the one hand, it gets us somewhere down the road, but it also gets really complicated, right? Now, because we can't easily play the perpetrator victim card, right? We can't say, and this is where a Latter-day Saint ethic, and this would be true of a Christian ethic, it's a Jewish ethic, this is not a Muslim ethic, it's not unique to Latter-day Saints, we just have our own spin on this. What it means is that we cannot reduce people to positions. We cannot reduce people to the things they do, but we have to, because we are also impelled towards justice. We also have to take seriously the things that are done, right? And that I agree with a lot of Jewish and Christian theologians who would say that in the Bible, that God has a preferential option for the poor, for the victim, for the weak, for the oppressed, for the marginalized. This is the Exodus story, right? And all the way through. And so I think we have to have that as well. So how do you do that, right? Have an option and a preference for the victims, for the marginalized, without ignoring and reducing the humanity of the people who are oppressing and doing violence to them, right? And recognizing that they are operating in cultural narratives and scripts that oftentimes they didn't choose and which are true, right, to some degree. So I think so for a Latter-day Saint, as we sit, especially those of us who sit comfortably here in the United States, right, half a world away from this, I would say we first have to think and always insist on and never give up on the full humanity of everybody, not the partial humanity, the full humanity of everybody involved. We start there. We never let go of that. And then we start to think about, okay, how do we apply a justice lens to this? How do we apply, some of these other theological lenses? But I think Latter-day Saint theology insists that no other cause, no other theological claim, no other belief in eschatology overrides the basic of humanity of any person. Nobody in Mormon theology gets sacrificed on the altar of expediency or some other theological point. So I don't care whatever the Book of Revelation says about Israel or prophecies or however you want to interpret. It doesn't matter, because you don't get to sacrifice the humanity of the people on the ground on the altar of your theological principle.
Right. I love that. And I think the other thing that does is it stops the rewind tape, right? Because like you said, you can rewind towards, well, we did that because this happened and they did that because that happened. And you can keep going further and further back of who was the initiator of violence. But if you say every person is a child of God and that is the guiding principle, then who is ultimately at fault or trying to place blame on, you know, a certain group, that no longer becomes the most important thing, right? What's the most important thing is that there has been enough violence and there shouldn't be one more person sacrificed to this narrative.
Yeah.
So it kind of stops the looking back, even though we always need the context of history, and says what's important now today is there's been too much violence and it needs to stop.
Yeah, exactly. And of course it gets very complicated because we live in a fallen world. We live in a world where nation states have borders, where evildoers do evil things, and we have to think about how we deal with that. We have to think about, like, national security. I think you can make a Christian argument for national security. I know a lot of Latter-day Saints, deeply sincere and devoted Latter-day Saints who work in the national security apparatus, especially in this country. And frankly, actually, one of the things that's changed for me over the past 20 years, when I wrote this article when I was in grad school, when I had full of these sort of idealistic notions about peace and so forth, it was easy for me to demonize them. Right? For somebody who would go to work for the CIA, for somebody who would go and work, the national security apparatus. And then a funny thing happened. Like, I got to know some of them. You know, I went to conferences and I met some of them. I read some of their work and I said, oh, my goodness, they're just as sincere and thoughtful as I am, maybe more so. Right. They are wrestling with these kinds of issues on a deeply Christian level. Right. And so then I have to extend that to my Israeli brothers and sisters, my Palestinian brothers and sisters, and all of those kinds of. So this isn't to dismiss those very complicated things we do with national security, but I do think, yeah, we put the human being first. And if we think about, extend that metaphor of the rewind tape, if we rewind it all the way back, Latter-day Saints theology actually has something to say about where violence comes from. It comes from Cain, who's inspired by Satan. Right. And so the original sin in Latter-day Saint theology is not Eve taking the fruit. Mm-hmm. Right. The original sin of humanity is violence. And that's what causes God to weep. It's not Eve taking the fruit. Right. And so that should then give us pause. In Latter-day Saint theology, there's no such thing as holy violence. There's no such thing as sacred violence. It always has its roots and can be traced back to Satan whispering in the ear of Cain to kill his brother. And so every act of violence, from then to putting Jesus on the cross to innocent people being killed today in 2025, it's all part of the same thread. So what that means is Latter-day Saints can never say that violence is sacred. It might be necessary. It might be justified in some cases, right? Again, those are arguments and conversations we can have. But Latter-day Saints can never say, if we're thinking properly theologically, at least in my opinion, that violence is holy or sacred.
What jumps into my mind right now is I think about sort of other discourses that have emerged in the last 20 years that may touch on peace building in some way. I was really happy about and this is maybe more tangentially connected, about the emphasis on refugees about 2016. And it was just, it was so wonderful to see our church like take on this really important social issue and really push this idea of we are going to help refugees. And it wasn't framed in terms of peace building. It was more framed in terms of charity. However, it seems like that was part of, I mean, you know, a little bit more distant, but it has to do with peace building. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And look, I think peace building is a big umbrella that lots of things fall under. And so absolutely, refugee assistance and resettlement, you know, humanitarianism, I mean, justice work, rule of law work. I mean, it all falls under peace building. And I don't care if people call it peace building. You can call it the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, I don't care what name you use for it, right, if you're doing the work. And I completely agree that refugee assistance program, the No More a Stranger, I Was a Stranger, a program that they developed was spectacular. And I love that the general authority who oversaw it at the time is now in the Quorum of the Twelve. Elder Patrick Kieran was in charge of those efforts in Europe. That was his assignment at the time. And I know that deeply affected him, and he has carried that with him. And in some ways, yeah, you're right, Caroline. In terms of it seems very distant, like that was Europe. And actually, if you talk to European saints, I'm like, that really mattered in their congregations, what they were doing. That's had long lasting effects. But here in the United States, maybe a little bit less so, except that Utah. Now, of course, I know not all Mormons live in Utah, right? But Utah matters, and Utah has been a notably friendly state to refugees, especially in terms of red states, right? It's one of the ways where Utah just does not follow course with normal red state politics, is that Utah is one of the most refugee-friendly states in the entire country. And that is clearly, and the leaders of the state, like the governor and other legislative leaders and others, I mean, they will specifically say it's because of our heritage, because of who we are, it's because how this state came to be. And so I think those things matter. This is where religious identity does matter. You know, back to your question, Margaret, right? Sometimes it surprises us. Sometimes, you know, people acting out of their own religious impulses, they go a little different way than what other people, even other kind of fellow travelers in their political party might go.
Oh, thank you so much. We should start wrapping this up. And so I'm going to once again bring us down to the practical here and just ask as a final question. And I think you've kind of touched on this throughout. But in your article from 20 years ago, you write that peace building requires, if nothing else, getting one's hands dirty. And so I'm thinking, how does the average woman, the average man, you know, how can we contribute towards peace building in that non-spectacular way? Are there things like, have you seen congregations be really creative in their peace building? Have you seen average, you know, LDS people engage in interesting ways in peace building on the ground?
Absolutely. And I actually love, Caroline, that we're ending with this question, because I think it's the question, right? It's one thing to talk about these things at a very high level, but like, what does it actually mean to be a peacemaker? Well, I think it means being a peacemaker on social media. Maybe it means unplugging from social media for a while, or maybe what it means is being a different kind of voice on social media and not participating in narratives of fear and marginalization and polarization, right? It's saying no to that, either by stepping away from it or actually inserting yourself. I mean, so you can be like that couple and actually put yourself in the middle in social media and say, let's change the discourse. Let's do it a different way. It happens most, you know, the most important peacemaking actually does happen in our homes, right? We're all surrounded by conflict, or in our workplaces, or in our neighborhoods, right? It might not be violent conflict. It's not the same kind that they're experiencing in Gaza or Ukraine. But we're all enmeshed and immersed in conflict every single day with our children, our spouses, our fellow ward members, right? I actually think this is part of the inspired part of the gospel, is these geographically defined wards that throw us together with people that we would never associate with otherwise. Wards are the perfect laboratory for peacemaking. Like, this is where we learn how to be peacemakers, right? Get together with a bunch of people you don't choose and maybe don't even like, and learn how to do things together constructively and productively. That's peacemaking. I once talked to a friend of mine. He was a professor at a private liberal arts college. So he spent his days there, you know, a very kind of, very thoughtful kind of intellectual climate. And he was also bishop of his ward. And his colleagues sometimes talked about like the bubble that he lived in as a Mormon. And he said, bubble? He says, like, this liberal arts college is a bubble, right? He says, as a bishop, let me tell you what I do. Like, I go into trailer parks and I'm dealing with couples where there's domestic violence, right? Or where kids have been abused. Or I'm dealing with really nasty divorces. Or I'm dealing with somebody whose spouse just died of cancer and now how are they going to pay the bills? Or I'm dealing with multi-generational poverty. Or I'm dealing with somebody who was just baptized into our church who you know, has drug addiction, right? He says, I live in a bubble when I come to work. Yeah. When I enter into the bishop's office, that's the opposite of a bubble. And I think if our wards are functioning properly, that's exactly the way they should be. They should be with arms open to all. And I think this is true in any ward. There are people struggling with addiction, with depression, with mental illness, with conflict, with divorce, possibly with abuse, you know, and violence and all these kinds of things. And so So I think we don't have to look very far to find opportunities to be peacemakers and to apply some of these principles, to be proactive. So we can do it individually, but then we can also do it as wards, right? So like relief societies can get involved in local refugee efforts. I mean, I've seen amazing examples of this. I've seen wards get involved in the local, you know, shelter for women who are victims of domestic violence, who are survivors of that, or children who are survivors of violence, right? And so oftentimes it's relief societies or elder quorums partnering with the local social service provider who's doing this kind of peacemaking work. We don't have to like invent this stuff, right? We don't have to reinvent the wheel or pretend like that we have to be the first. In fact, I actually think Latter-day Saints are the best, because what we do is we bring like people power. We bring volunteers. We don't always bring expertise, but we bring like a lot of people who are willing to help and get in and get our hands dirty. And so if we let other people be the experts, and we become the people power, I think we can do a lot of good in our communities in terms of peacemaking. But for crying out loud, like our political situation right now is just crying out for peacemakers. And every single one of us can decide that we're going to engage in politics. I don't care whether you're left, right, center, whatever, right? But you can engage the political sphere as a peacemaker. That's a choice that we make. So, yeah, I think peacemaking opportunities are all around us. You don't have to go halfway across the world to be a peacemaker. You can do it in your community, in your home, in your ward, right in front of you.
Well, that is a fantastic note to end on. Patrick, thank you so much for coming today and talking with us. I think your insights are invaluable. And this is going to be, I think, a really important podcast for people to listen to. So thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you again. And I am just absolutely with you, especially about the work that we can do right now in reaching out to refugee agencies. They need support more than ever. So your work continues to challenge and inspire us to think about peace, not just as a personal virtue, but as a communal and spiritual imperative. And I've personally seen the miracles that happen in a ward when they get involved in peace building, and specifically with supporting the refugee community. So thank you for advocating for that. And that's it for this episode of Dialogue Unbound. We're so grateful that you joined us for this conversation about war, peace, and what it means through a Mormon context. We are excited to continue this series, and thank you again for listening and walking this path with us. If you liked this episode, please subscribe, share it with a friend, leave us a review. It helps other people find these conversations. And don't forget to listen to the audio version of Patrick Mason's 2004 dialogue article on this topic. Until next time, I'm Margaret Olson Hemming.
And I am Caroline Klein.
And this is Dialogue Unbound.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.